from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Today, Mark Frauenfelder, the keynote speaker for the April 1st and 2nd Digital Media in a Social World conference, talks to me about his book, Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. Then, OSU student Kate Satche reviews Read This Next, 500 of the best books you'll ever read. So stay tuned. Mark Frauenfelder, thank you for being on Writer's Talk. I'd like to talk to you about your new book, which has been featured on the Colbert Report, where you've been playing your cigar box guitar, which is shown on the front of your book, Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. So welcome.
Thanks a lot, Doug. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you here as well. And I want to start by complimenting you. On page 169 of your book, you mentioned the Ohio State University and our BMITES research. Thank you for calling out to the Ohio State University.
Oh, sure. Well, thanks for doing research on BMITES. It's, you know, it's very important.
Yes. So I'm glad to have that connection there. And we always look to bring up the school whenever we can. But in a more meaningful way, I wanted to talk to you about some of the things that you had mentioned in this book, which is all about how you can find meaning, as you say, in a throwaway world. And one of the quotes that you have in here is meaningful connections to objects. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that and tell me what you had in mind by that phrase, because it informs so much of what happens in the book.
Sure. So what I mean by that is, if you have an active role in making something, whether, you know, it's your own musical instrument or food or, you know, even something that you carve out of wood, or if you rewire a lamp, you kind of invest yourself into that thing so that you tend to care more about it. You understand it more. If something goes wrong with it, you have a better idea of how to fix it and maintain it. And being more aware and like mindful of that thing kind of extends beyond that thing. So, for example, I make cigar box guitars. And so now when I see stringed instruments, a new one somewhere, I take a much closer look at it than I did before. And it's kind of opened my eyes and kind of changed the way that I view those things. You know, I'm interested in the way that they're manufactured and some of the innovations they have. So it gives you a new appreciation for kind of the human-made world around you. And having this kind of relationship with things turned out for me to be a really rewarding and fulfilling way to live. By nature, I don't think I'm a very observant person, and this kind of makes me more observant. And by being more observant, I think you are more present and mindful of things, which, you know, to me is a positive thing.
Now, you've said mindful a couple of times. That's also used often in meditation, mindfulness meditation. Is that something that you're drawing on, the sense of slowing down and being more aware of surroundings? I mean, it seems like it informs much of what you're doing. Do you meditate frequently?
Not really. I mean, you know, I before we had kids, when I had more time to do things like yoga, you know, part of the thing we did every, you know, couple times a week was meditation. And I really enjoyed that a lot, you know, breathing. And just one of the best meditating methods that I was ever taught was to just listen to sounds, to the ambient sounds around you while you're sitting in a room. And it really does put you into the present. And, you know, you kind of stop thinking about the past and the future. And I think that happens a lot when you're making things, especially like wood carving or something, for instance. You can really just get into an interesting flow state where you're, you know, using your hands. I think it's a lot like knitting, where they've done studies with knitting and how it kind of causes the relaxation response in people, where their heart rate goes down and their blood pressure goes down and their brain waves are calmer. And I feel that happens a lot when you're making things. It's a nice, pleasant feeling, and it's a great break for me to get away from the computer, because I spend so much of my work involves working on the computer, that to just go outside in the weather and work on something is a wonderful mini vacation from what I do every day.
Right, and the writing that you do every day. And you've written for so many different publications, from, as I understand it, Playboy to Wired magazine, to writing a couple books, to doing sort of participatory journalism for a website when you moved to an island. with your family. And I'm curious about how you approach those different kinds of writing processes. If you're looking to write a whole book about DIY versus you're writing, you know, a couple of articles about something, how did you feel that this book was different in the writing of it, say, stringing it together? Or was it sort of a larger assignment? Just you took it as piecemeal, though.
I've written a few books before. This, I think, is my sixth book. But most of my books were approached kind of like articles. They were like short pieces of information. I did one like an illustrated history of computers, and it was, photographs from prehistory, until today. And each one was like a short article. So this book was really the first one where I had really a long story to tell. And at first I was going to approach it, I thought I was going to just do like profiles of really interesting DIYers and the maker movement and kind of the role of the maker movement in our culture. But after researching it for a while, I became so interested in becoming more active in DIY that I thought it might be more fun to tell the story through my own experiences. And so it ended up becoming, a book about my attempts to become a DIYer and what I learned from all of these people that I kind of considered alpha makers or extreme DIYers, and how I incorporated what I learned from them into my own life in a way that was reasonable, for my situation. And that turned out, I think, to be a good idea, because it was more interesting for me to write the book that way. And I think people like stories, first-person stories about kind of new adventures that people go on, starting out naive about something and gaining experience as they go along.
And you've got a lot of this participatory journalist traits in this, as you said, making it about your own story. And some things that went well and some things that didn't go well. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is a quote that you've got. Recent brain research suggests that making mistakes is one of the best ways to learn. And you chronicle some of the mistakes you made in here, making some of the things that you might have done differently, raising chickens,
example. That was a big one. So when I started the book, we lived in a part of Los Angeles called Tarzana. And we had a half acre that was all enclosed by a fence. And so the chickens had free run of the whole yard. We had six really nice Plymouth Barred Rock chickens, and they just loved it. They, ran around the yard, and they ate all the bugs, and they took dust baths. And whenever I stepped outside, they would follow me, because they knew I would have a treat for them. It was just really a lot of fun. And then we moved to a Studio City about 10 miles away, and it's in the hills here in Los Angeles. And I built a new chicken coop, and the area was fenced in, but in the hills here, I just didn't realize how many predators there are. There are coyotes and bobcats and raccoons and hawks, skunks, all sorts of animals that see chickens as tasty and easy sources of calories. So they slowly just got picked off one by one. I tried a lot of different things, but, every one of them ended up being a mistake. And that was probably the worst of the mistakes, was losing all of those chickens to predators. And what I ended up doing and what I realized was that I only want to do DIY projects that kind of work with my situation and the environment I live in. And to fight against the environment that way, if it's not necessary, is really something that I didn't want to do anymore. So instead of raising chickens now, the thing I'm working on is making an orchard on our property. And I think that's, it's great. We get the, a good amount of sun, and it's sloped, so a sloped hill. So the land can't be used for much else, but I think it would be good to grow trees there on the hillside. So that's what I'm working on now. I'm sure I'll make plenty of mistakes along the way, but so far it's been a lot of fun.
Well, there's less tension, though, as a story, to have raised trees than to raise chickens, because you describe one episode in here in which you come upon a predator that's gotten into the chicken area, and you, I think, chase it off.
Yeah.
And then it takes two chickens, and one gets dropped outside the fence area, and you try to nurse it back to health. And I won't go into how that story ends, but, the trees will be much longer. Much less dramatic, I think, than the chickens have been.
Exactly.
Now, I've read that you said in terms of DIY, the do-it-yourself movement, that as long as there isn't a safety concern, say that you're building something that could fall on somebody or you're doing something that could cause you medical problems because of, you know, issues that you're not familiar with as a DIYer, that you should go ahead and try it, is kind of the advice I've gotten.
Yeah.
My interpretation of the advice that you get. So tell me about what do you think is the one that was the most interesting to try, or perhaps the one that was the most difficult to write about or the most challenging to write about, to find an entry into it as a DIY project?
It could be writing about my espresso machine experiences, because, you know, what I did was I opened up my espresso machine and removed the existing thermostat in the espresso machine and replaced it with a thermocouple and a kind of a sophisticated temperature control system. So it sounded kind of dry and technical, and I wasn't really sure how I was going to approach that. But I think, you know, I kind of humanized the story by visiting with this guy named Kyle Glanville here in LA, who recently won the National Barista Championships. So he's basically the best espresso maker in the country. And he gave me lessons on how to make espresso using my machine. And then, you know, one of the things he told me was that temperature control was one of the most important things that you could do when you make coffee. And the espresso machine that I had, the temperature can vary as much as 40 degrees, the water temperature, which is like a huge range. And you cannot get consistently good coffee with it as it stands unless you either practice something called temperature surfing, which is kind of this elaborate button and switch flipping choreography to get the water temperature to come out at the right temperature, or you can replace some of the components of your machine with a new system, this little mini computer and thermocouple. It's called a proportional integral derivative temperature control system. So, you know, I installed that, and then it turned out that it worked really well. And espresso's a big part of my life. I make it, you know, 2 to 3 times a day at home. And so that experience of replacing the components and now having espresso that's better every single day really had an impact on my life, because it's part of my daily routine.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with my guest, Mark Frauenfelder, the keynote speaker for the April 1st and 2nd Digital Media in a Social World Conference. More information about this conference, which also features dozens of workshops and presentations about digital and social media like Facebook, Twitter, Pachakacha, and educational gaming, among others, can be found at www.dmsw.osu.edu. And the most important fact, it's free. Now, back to my discussion with Mark Frauenfelder.
I got to say, I'm a little resentful because you've made me want to own the machine that you described, the Rensilio Silvia, I think is what it's called. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that
correctly. Yeah, I think that's it.
In the book, you identify it as a $500 machine, and I just Googled it, and I can't find it under $650. So
yeah,
I think you've helped the sales of this thing. Because you describe the God Shot, which is pulling sort of the perfect cup of espresso. And I'm a big coffee fan, and you've made it sound so appealing in here. I'm afraid that I'll have to go out and buy one of these now and convince my wife to go into that. But it also was a moment where I thought there was this interesting tension, because at the same time that you're adding the PID control, this sophisticated temperature control, that sort of takes it's a DIY moment, because you're changing this espresso machine. Mm-hmm. That's especially well suited for DIYers, but it also takes some of the humanness, some of the variability out of it. I was actually drawn to your description of the surfing, the temperature surfing, because that relies upon the person to pull the perfect shot. And I've read before that, you know, baristas, the reason that they have these competitions is to, you know, the really good barista is really held in high regard. And in Italy, they're something approaching gods, I understand.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a really interesting tension there, because the barista seems like the ultimate sort of professional, the kind of DIYer who's really doing it for the human element, but at the same time, there's the DIY that wants to make sure you've controlled all the elements in a really sophisticated way. When you're done with the PID installation on the Rensselaer Silvia, I think you say it varies like less than a 1 degree centigrade.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It locks it in. And, you know, that is interesting, and it's something that that idea of where you draw the line between doing things by hand and incorporating automation or machinery into your process. That was something that I thought about in a lot of different ways. And for me, the espresso machine, having the temperature control, it was fun to hack the machine and stuff. And I still think that there's enough variables left there to make it a human element in there, you know, getting the grind right, selecting the beans, how long you keep the shot pulled, you know, steaming the milk if you want to do the latte art on top. And so that was kind of my comfort level, and people have different levels. That was the same way with like carving wooden spoons. You know, it takes me a long time to carve a spoon, a few hours probably. And I, at one point, I thought, you know, I could really probably cut at least 2 hours out of the process by using a jigsaw to rough out the shape of the spoon. But I thought that wasn't, for some reason, that wasn't something I wanted to do. I would rather start with the piece of wood and just use hand tools the entire time. And, you know, somebody else might prefer to use a power tool to rough out the shape. So that was an, like you said, it's an interesting tension, and everybody has their different comfort and interest levels.
Right. I started to wonder I'm assuming you wrote this book on computer, but you could have written it out longhand. You know, make your own pencil, write it out on paper you made yourself. You know?
That would have been fun, actually, if I would have thought, if we would have talked about that earlier, maybe I would have tried that.
That's your next book, in which you make all the paper yourself.
Exactly.
Chew it, you know, chew the wood in your mouth, like a wasp spitting it out and doing all that.
There are people who make their own pencils, and it looks like a lot of fun. Something that we've thought about running and make is, you know, make your own pencils. Maybe we'll have to revisit that.
All right. Well, I guess my final question is, I'm curious about your family's reaction to the kinds of things you've done. For example, you talked about doing the spoons, and you give the spoons as gifts. What is their regard for the objects that you've made? You describe your wife, I think, liking the spoons, asking you to make some for people for Christmas mm-hmm. presents or gifts at some point. What happens when you make something and you, say, give it to somebody in your family? Do they regard it in the same way because they know that you've written about it, because they know that that's something that's not only something you made, but something that you're invested in as a writer?
They like the things, and, you know, they've said really nice things about them. And I think, you know, it's less about the fact that it's been part of what I've written about, and just that it's something that's, they can tell, A, it took a lot of time to create for them, and it's something that's unique, and it's something that they can use. So, you know, we gave people eggs, gave them spoons. I've given away quite a few cigar box guitars to people, and we've recently started giving little jars of honey to people. And so these are all things that have a function and can actually be used, and so people are really appreciative of them, and I've actually, you know, inspired a number of people to actually start raising chickens and building chicken coops and making their own yogurt and sauerkraut and kombucha. I've been making kombucha, and I've given away quite a number of, they're called mushrooms. They're not really mushrooms, but, you know, the kombucha mushroom that ferments the sugared tea into kombucha. I've given away quite a few of those to people. And so it's fun hearing back from them that they've had a successful kombucha fermentation. So it's been a great way to share things with people. And that's one of my favorite things to do.
I'll end by saying that I think that your book is dangerous because it made me think about doing all these things. I already make yogurt. I'm trying this experiment with making soap out of, I probably shouldn't admit this, but hamburger drippings.
Uh-huh. That's great. We have an article in Make about making soap out of bacon, and it actually looks like bacon.
Oh man, I don't know that I could pass that off on my family. I'm pretty sure that I'd be alone. I was going to do candles, but I found out that tallow-based candles are really not a very good candle, and so I gave up on that idea, and I've moved on to soap.
That sounds cool. I've got to try making soap.
Well, maybe I should let you handle it and write about it, and then I can follow along with whatever directions come out and do that. Well, Mark Frauenfelder, I thank you very much for talking to us today on Writer's Talk. I appreciate what you're doing. And you've got a couple of websites. The one that I know of most notably is Boing Boing.
Yeah.
And again, thank you very much. And the book is Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World by Mark Frauenfelder. And it's available at all great bookstores. So I wish you a good day.
Thanks a lot, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Are you looking for a book to read? How about one that tells you what other books you should read? Kate Sachi, OSU student, will give you the inside scoop.
I sometimes feel like lists of books to read are a dime a dozen. I get them at work, in school, at home, but I'm a sucker for them. It's fun to recognize an old favorite on one of those lists, and discovering a great book, that's the best. But lists abound between the Goodreads website and the Lifetime Reading List. Who needs another collection of book recommendations? Me, as it turns out. And if you're listening to Writer's Talk, I'm willing to bet you'll enjoy Read This Next, 500 of the Best Books You'll Ever Read. The collection is stellar. The selections, the annotations, the organization, and the editing. It's organized by theme. Love, memoir, family, history, politics, humor, work, and money, war, religion, and the inevitable death. Each theme begins with an introduction that gives readers a taste of what's to come. In the heart of the chapter, the authors give the title and author of the book, a brief summary, and discussion questions. The annotations are witty and informative. The discussion questions aren't something you'd write an essay about, though they'd be fun at a book club over a glass of wine. The recommended books are refreshingly diverse. I was really pleasantly surprised that there were no arbitrary divisions between fiction and nonfiction, past and present, obscure and infamous. In addition to the annotated recommendations, Newman and Middlemark include related Read These Too sidebars. For example, after describing Out of Africa, a memoir by a Danish woman who moves to Kenya, the authors give a list of books by actual Africans. The small sections are a great idea and add to the volume. Newman and Middlemark write with real enthusiasm and passion for books, and their recommendations are entertaining and well-researched without being erudite. If you're looking for a good book to read, they'll point you in the right direction. Read This Next, 500 of the Best Books You'll Ever Read, was published by HarperCollins and is available at your local bookstore. Enjoy.
One, two, three, four.
Bajo el cielo de azul, canta mi alma sincera. He pasado por donde quiera. Sobre estos llanos y sierras, no me mires de extranjero, somos pasajeros no más. El sol y la luna nos brillan igual, rodando aquí en nuestra tierra. Quiero saber tu historia, tus sueños y tu desear. Yo pienso que nuestros cuentos serían casi igual. No me mires de extranjero, somos pasajeros no más. El sol y la luna nos brillan igual, rodando aquí en nuestra tierra. Thank you.
the big sky of blue. My heart will tell you a story. Your heart can tell me one too. We don't seem too much like strangers. We're doing the best that we can. The sun and the moon shine above as we circle below here on our little planet. Bajo el cielo de azul, canta mi alma sincera. He pasado por donde quiera, sobre estos llanos y sierras. No me mires de extranjero, somos pasajeros no más. El sol y la luna nos brillan igual, rodando aquí en nuestra tierra. The sun and the moon shine above as we circle below.
That was recent Writers Talk guest Tish Hinojosa playing in the studio for us. You can watch that video on YouTube by visiting www.writerstalk.org. For more information about Mark Frauenfelder, keynote speaker for the April 1st and 2nd Digital Media in a Social World Conference, visit www.dmsw.osu.edu. Writers Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel, where you can watch our interviews at www.ohiochannel.org, or you can check your local television listings. Join me next time for OSU social media experts Ryan Squire, Deborah Jasper, and Sean Holloway discussing the changing landscape of media. Plus, members of the OSU Intergalactic Science Fiction Club discuss the future of science fiction with sci-fi author Delson Armstrong. Until then, this is Doug Dangler. Keep writing. Abuelita talks of sins of man.